your order for 2007 session.
Have we heard that before?
Oh, yeah, right.
Hey, deja vu here.
Promises, promises, promises.
Get you nowhere.
I think I shot my credibility for the session right there. We're going to work on Senate Bill 111B, relating to use of physical force. Senator Westland, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senate Bill 111 makes a number of changes relating to the use of deadly force by law enforcement officers. This bill requires a plan be prepared for each county, which must be approved by governing authorities of the law enforcement agencies and the Attorney General. Also addressed in the bill are procedures for citizens to challenge the plans and the responsibilities of officers and their agencies in the case where deadly force is used. The B6 Amendment removes those sections dealing with the role of grand juries and the reporting of their proceedings. This bill provides $182,161 of general fund to the Department of Justice for a part-time position to review the plans and provide assistance to local governments in preparing those plans. Most of this funding is for grants to local governments to cover up to 75% of the cost of implementing and amending the plans. I recommend Senate Bill 111 be amended and reported out do pass as amended. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Discussion. Representative Morgan.
Thank you. Question for the carrier.
Of course.
In Section 7 of the bill, which is on page 8 of the amendments that we have, it has a notwithstanding clause that is an opt-out in case there's insufficient funding. Given that the funding is only 75%, or that the maximum amount of funding is only 75% of the expenses incurred, what is insufficient funding there?
What I think would be most appropriate at this time, if I may, Mr. Co-Chair, is to invite up the Attorney General, who was instrumental in the crafting and nurturing of this bill. Perhaps Doug Wilson should join him as well. But
I think that'd be a good idea. Mr. Wilson, you want to come up along with Attorney General, please? Thank you, Mr. Myers, for coming. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Doug, why don't you take a first stab at it, and we'll let the...
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, to Senator, actually Representative Morgan's question, my reading of that would mean that if all the money that were available for grants were spent for the first X number of counties, then if another county applied, that would mean that it would be insufficient. Now, if the... I draft that section or work closely on this bill, so if the Attorney General reads it a different way, I will definitely hear his opinion.
Can I just lay one more question on the table before we proceed with this? Because
sure.
It also says that the funding is available to grants that are awarded after the process is completed. It's for expenses incurred. And so I'm just curious about how that would fit into the equation, how you would figure out whether there was sufficient or insufficient monies if none of the reimbursements could take place until after the process was completed.
Thank you for the question.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, I'm looking for language. I do recall that the money was supposed to be used for amending the plan and implementing the plan, I believe. I remember that word in some place, but I cannot find it right off the top of my head, which would then I would interpret that it would the county or the parties in the county would have to prepare the plan, but in terms of implementing and amending it, that is where the reimbursement would take place.
Mr. Attorney General, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Co-Chair, two components. There's first a provision in Section 4 that provides that the grant may not exceed 75% of the expenses, and also a provision that, let me just find it here, a provision in Section 7 that excuses compliance. It says sufficient monies are not appropriated to the department for making, for purposes of making grants under Section 4. A deadly physical force authority is not required to comply with any requirement of certain sections, but to cause the expenses to be incurred. And then there's a further provision by which the department, it's in Section 11, Mr. Cochera and Dr. Morgan, a provision by which the law enforcement agency that participates is directed to keep track of the expenses that occurs, and those expenses included are not limited to personnel costs, and the Department of Justice is to award a law enforcement agency one credit for each dollar of expenses incurred before July 1st by reason of the agency's participation. And that interaction with the following provisions would make it theoretically possible, I think, for a particular agency to recover 100% of the types of costs that I've described, up to, of course, the exhaustion of the ability to provide that money to a given agency. That's when the agency is excused. Or jurisdiction. That's when the earlier provisions I mentioned would excuse the agency from further compliance with the provisions of the Act.
Thank you.
So, just to make sure I've got this all straight in my head. So, first of all, a local authority has to actually go through the process of planning and then submit their expenses for reimbursement. And if there isn't enough money, they can at that point opt out of the process. And if there's too much money, then jurisdictions can apply for more reimbursement. Am I getting this straight?
Mr. Attorney General.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, I believe that's correct. Now, to be quite candid with the committee, it would be my intention if the interactions of the provisions of the bill were to exhaust the ability of the department to provide the circumstances in which reimbursement according to formula could fully occur for a given jurisdiction, I would be respectfully returning to the emergency board to seek some, what would probably be a relatively small supplemental appropriation to permit the whole process to resume and be carried out by each jurisdiction.
Just a comment, if I might, to complete this train of thought, Mr. Kocher. This is clearly underfunded at the get-go. There's only 75% of the money here that's available. So if all the jurisdictions draw on this, we're going to come up 25% short. If not all of the jurisdictions draw on this, then there is no provision for that. So essentially, you can't opt out because you can't prove that there's insufficient monies, although there is insufficient monies up front. But you won't be able to know for sure that there's insufficient monies until you've started the process and incurred cost in your planning. So I think that the fiscal mechanism for this is clearly flawed, and that this is supposed to be the fiscal part of this process. And if we put a bill out that has this much uncertainty and a guarantee to insufficiency, I don't think we're doing our job.
Appreciate the comments. See, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to understand this. The first thing I have, first question I have is that I'm understanding that all the counties are obligated to go through a planning process on this. Is that correct,
Mr. Attorney General?
Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct.
And they go through the planning process on this, and in the process of going through that, they incur costs. But then, after incurring these costs, they may be reimbursed for these costs.
Is that a rhetorical question?
It's a question.
Yeah. Mr. Attorney General, I believe the answer is yes. Is that correct?
Yes.
But then,
if there is money available to repay them for planning that they've already done, then they don't have to do the planning they've already done.
No, I think it's a question of following through with the grant program and implementation, sir. That's why I read it.
Well, I... I mean, I realize, you know, what the intention... Excuse me, Mr. Co-Chair. I realize what the intention, I think, is here. But it seems to me that we've got a real wording problem, you know, with this. And I...
Mr. Attorney General, do you have any confusion?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Jensen, the intention in the interaction between Section 7 and Section 11 of the bill is to recognize that there may be insufficient funds that are going to be available, and to excuse the process of further compliance at that point. That's at least the intention. And also, however, the amount of funding for which an individual jurisdiction could be eligible is also augmented in Section 11, according to the provisions there, by this process of crediting expenses incurred, and a direction that, to the extent the funds are appropriated to the department for the purpose, the department shall make a grant that exceeds 75% of the expenses incurred if the agency has unused credits awarded under subsection 2. Now, I might add, Co-Chair Representative Jensen, that we tried to do, I think, a careful job in calculating what we think the eligible expenses would be across the jurisdictions. Of course, this is the first time that we will have embarked on this kind of a collaborative process, state and local process, in this particular kind of process. But that's at least the intention right now. The appropriation is intended to be sufficient to provide the full initial 75% eligibility, and then the additional amounts that will be available under this accrediting process that's described in Section 11. You know, these are estimates, of course, at this point, because this is a new process.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Let's see, Representative Shields, I think, did you have a question?
Briefly, my understanding is that this amendment not only takes out the grand jury portion, but restores the public inquest portion to its previous position. Is that correct?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Shields, that is correct.
Thank you. Representative Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I wonder how many of the local planning authorities of the 36 counties submitted a cost estimate to produce the work that's required by this bill?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hanna, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
Follow up, Mr. Rocco, do you have any cost estimates that were provided by the local planning authorities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannon, I do not believe we do.
Excellent. Thank you. Doug, do you think off the top of your head, Mr. Wilson, do you think off the top of your head you'd be able to make a guesstimate of the personnel costs within public safety budgets?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hannon, out of the ones that have passed the legislature so far, including corrections, you're probably talking in excess of $1 billion in public safety.
Let me clarify, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Clarification.
I'm talking about the percentage of dollars required for personnel in those budgets.
I would estimate that, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hanna, roughly 70%. I'd have to go back and check.
Thank you. And I was going to guess somewhere between 60 and 80. And just further comment, Mr. Co-Chair, as I read this piece about expense, you know, and to the to the point that we're talking about the fiscal here, you know, we don't have any cost estimates from any of these planning authorities for this project, number one. Number two is, we're talking about funding 75% of 20% of the cost. If we say that, that 80% of the cost that's going to go into doing this, when this gets out to the local counties and local planning authorities, will be personnel expense, which is really what it's going to be. I mean, it's the people doing the work that's going to be the cost here. It's the amount of paper they're going to use or the gas they burn getting to the county seat to do it is going to be a minimum compared to the personnel cost. So we're limiting it already by not allowing reimbursement on expense for personnel costs, as I read this in Section 4, so we're really funding 75% of what might be 20 or 30% of the project. So when you talk about underfunding this thing, and you talk about rural counties and unfunded mandates, these folks that have to travel and do all the things and send a deputy or send a state policeman or send somebody else, this is a burdensome project, and I would suggest that we haven't done our financial homework on this project.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chair. There's some information I'd like to get on the record. And before I do that, I want to honor the leadership of Mr. Attorney General Myers in bringing this public policy forward and honoring that quality of leadership. Also put on record that our Attorney General convened a use of deadly force task force in 2004. This was a diverse statewide task force with subcommittees. These groups met over several months to carefully study the many, many issues and perspectives related to this complex topic. The Attorney General also held listening groups in community forums to gather public input. And this work product resulted in a 46-page report, which is available at, and I'm going to give the website, mindful that we have folks out there in internet land listening to us. It's www.doj.state.orgus. And the work product also resulted in Senate Bill 301B last session. And last session, there was much work on a compromise and consensus that was achieved, but a final bill was not passed. When we held our floor debate on the Senate floor, the days are all blending, a few days ago, we had a floor letter from our Attorney General, and Mr. Co-Chair, I'd like to put some portion of that content on the record. The Attorney General wrote that peace officers serve and protect their fellow Oregonians. We have equipped them with deadly weapons and have by state law granted them the extraordinary authority to take lives, if necessary, to fulfill the missions that they have assigned to them. Given the special nature of that authority and the challenges faced by law enforcement in deciding when and how to use it, law enforcement and the wider community share an interest in proper training in deadly force use. Adequate support for all officers and civilian members of the community involved in a deadly force incident and all families affected by a deadly force incident, and the process for investigating a deadly force incident and determining whether the use of deadly force complied with law and policy. Overlaying all these aspects of law enforcement's use of deadly force is Oregon's increasingly diverse population and the need to ensure that law enforcement's use of force is free of both the perception and the reality of racial, ethnic, or other impermissible bias. That ends the portion of the letter that I wanted to quote for the record. I would also point out to us colleagues that this policy is a significant and major advance in the administration of justice in the state of Oregon. And it has been pointed out by others who have looked at where we would stand without this legislation, is that when these tragic events occur in our communities, when these tragic events occur around the use of deadly force, without this legislation, what you will have is communities continuing to rally around fear based on lack of information. Officers will continue to feel isolated, and district attorneys will be faced with ongoing political pressure during tragic incidents of deadly force. As I stated, this is a significant advancement in the administration of justice, in my view, and the Attorney General has presented us, and all of those who have worked with the Attorney General going back to 2004 have provided us with a great opportunity to make this advancement real. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Further discussion, Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just checking if, say, we represent a lot of rural counties and say they don't have the resources and they don't turn in a report, what is the sanction?
There is none. My understanding, colleagues, that I think we're overthinking this just a little bit, but that may be me, but I think a lot of the counties are perhaps not interested in pursuing this. There are a number that are, and there's money available, I think, for those that are interested in pursuing this. For now, we'll see how it works out. Next session, hopefully we can revisit, make the appropriate accommodation.
So, in other words, if they didn't want to participate, they didn't have to, even though it says they shall provide this plan.
They can make a plan, but participation appears to be completely optional. Mr. Attorney General, you have a different interpretation.
Mr. Co-Chair, with respect, yes, I think I do. I think that the bill mandates the creation in each county of the deadly force planning authority.
But as far as implementation goes, there's no obligation, as I understood.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I think that it's intended that the process would carry through in each county to the creation of plans that meet the descriptions that are in the bill and are developed according to the memberships that are prescribed and that are subjected to the review process that the measure sets up. That is to say, you have your planning authority and then the governing body of each law enforcement agency within the county, except for the Department of State Police or the Department of Justice, are expected to approve or disapprove a plan submitted to it from this initial planning body. The district attorney and sheriff, a non-management police officer selected by those two officials, at least one city within the county, the chief, the police chief selected by the chiefs within the county, a representative of the public selected by the district attorney and sheriff, a representative of the Oregon State Police, with the district attorney and the sheriff as the co-chairpersons of this sort of planning group.
I'm sorry, perhaps my, this is a good discussion. My understanding is that, yes, there is the plan that has to be developed, but whether or not the plan is used or the grand jury accommodations are used, I understood to be optional. Once the plan is set up, it's not necessary that every county follow and implement the plan itself.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I think the bill contemplates that the plan that works its way through this process would be implemented. But that the planning process itself, that is the process of getting to the plan, is dependent on the availability of the funding.
Mr. Wilson,
I might add, if I might, Mr. Co-Chair and members, that both the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association have endorsed this measure, as they did, I think, 2 years ago, and I presume that they are very familiar with its provisions with respect to the planning process and have not, to my knowledge, registered any concern or objection with respect to how that planning process is set up, and also in terms of the at least the initial funding that the bill makes available for purposes of grant making by the Department of Justice.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, as I interpret the language on page 5 of the amendment, lines 22 in section 4, the grants can be used for implementing and revising the plans, not developing the plans, and that's how I read it. And then the costs back in section 11, the credits, which are limited to personnel costs, then allow a jurisdiction to be paid more for more than 75% of funds are available for those costs of implementing and revising the plans. That's how I read it. Someone reads it a little differently in terms of interpretation that may want to be discussed, but I think that's how I read the bill. So that the counties or the local jurisdictions, as I see it, would incur the cost of the planning. The grants are for the implementation and the revising of a plan after approval. I'm not sure if that's the intent, but that's how I read the language.
Senator Devlin and Senator Gorley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is from the standpoint of supporting the bill. My understanding in this is that, of course, this planning would occur. Obviously, we have some jurisdictions that have some elements of this already in existing plans for law enforcement agencies, but not all. In any planning process like this, I think the jurisdictions would make some determination of what resources they had in terms of drafting the plan to actually meet the requirements. So I think that it's actually putting these elements in place, giving them some resources in terms of implementing, and actually it's in terms of the ultimate resources in terms of training and other aspects, that's probably, in a sense, some jurisdiction will determine that in the planning process based on the resources that they have available. That would be my read on it.
I think that's where I was trying to get at. Thank you. Let's see. Senator Gorley, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I would just put forth at this point in our discussion, which is a good discussion, and I'm glad we're having it, that the public policy interest here and the bottom line from where I sit is that there's no current statutory requirement for Oregon police agencies to develop a use of force policy. And in fact, we have some agencies that operate without having any use of force policy at all. And that's one of the things that we're needing to address. That's one of the things that must change. In one summary of this was a report on in summary of deadly force law enforcement agencies, a survey, 55% of the respondents, and there were 79, indicate that they had no element dealing with education, outreach, and training about the use of deadly force for police officers. Again, we need some standards. In the absence of no standards, and we need an approach in the law that states that we have an expectation in that regard.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to also put on the record that there were, by my count, 68 people involved in the Attorney General's task force that looked at this issue, from police officers to district attorneys throughout the state. People like Tim McLean at Oregon State Police, Gary Williams, Crook County DA, Mike Dugan, the Deschutes County DA, Raul Ramirez, Marion County Sheriff, and I think, you know, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is just kind of nudge counties along to come up with a policy for this. And also the Police Officers Association, which did have some problems with the bill and with the grand jury piece, are now okay with the bill as well. And perhaps Mr. Co-Chair, what you might have been thinking about as far as the optional portion was one of the amendments that was floated around in the last couple of days that allowed the grand jury portion to be optional based on the district attorney. So it's a pretty, I mean, there have been a lot of moving parts to this, and I thought maybe that might have been what you were thinking.
Mr. Co-Chair, I might add,
the Attorney General, please.
And as I noted earlier, both the sheriffs and the Association of Chiefs support this measure, and I presume they are familiar with its provisions and have an understanding of exactly how they will operate in relation to the costs that might be incurred. The district attorneys, for their part, have taken a neutral position. The counties have taken a neutral position. So I think the two organizations most that will be most involved, labor law enforcement organizations, will probably be most involved, have been supportive of the measure as it stands before you now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I can't believe that individual county and municipal law enforcement don't already have a public policy in regards to using deadly force already on the books, but I agree with the intent of the bill as described by the good senator from Portland, but the funding mechanism is going to cause a great deal of confusion and is flawed. So I'll be opposing this bill.
Well, come on, sure. Senator Virgil and Senator Ritzett.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It seems to me very clear as far as the process is concerned, but it does say that they shall conduct at least one public hearing in the process. So it looks to me like to have a plan, it's mandated that you have a plan, because later on in the bill it says if that plan is not acceptable, you must have a revised plan. I think the funding mechanism is still not clear to me. I'd ask for clarification from the Attorney General. Is it true that the grant is only there for reimbursement of the expenses of the planning, or is it, as Mr. Wilson discussed, that is not the full intent of the grant?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Berger, in section 4, the funds appropriated to the Department of Justice are for grants to reimburse the agencies for expenses incurred in implementing and revising the plans. Implementing and revising the plans. For purposes of the reimbursement.
So, Mr. Chair, so that means, period, that's what the grant is for. It's strictly for expenses that have been incurred by the county in putting the plan together.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Berger, I think implementation and revision are a step beyond just the creation of the plan itself.
All right, thank you.
Senator Ritzett, your turn.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One of the law enforcement agencies in the four counties that I represent, all rural counties, are underfunded and understaffed. And I think this bill exacerbates both that underfunding and further stresses the understaffing. I can find no way to understand how this bill is not an unfunded mandate. And after hearing this learned discussion in this old country, that is even more confused about what is actually in this bill. And we've heard what it does require the rural law enforcement agencies to do from three different aspects at least, and perhaps I'm just too dense to understand how they come together, but I don't see them coming together in the three different versions, and so I'm having trouble supporting this bill.
And then ask the co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just want to call people's attention to page 4 of the amendment. particularly subsection 12 on line 9. Notwithstanding subsection 10A above, a law enforcement agency is not subject to a provision of a plan approved hereunder that either conflicts with a provision of a city or county charter or general ordinance that applies to that law enforcement agency, or, most importantly to this discussion, imposes an obligation not required under Section 5 if complying with the provision would require the law enforcement agency to budget monies or submit a revenue measure for a vote of the people in order to comply with the provision. To my reading, that means that there is some discretion at the local level and it is not something that imposes an unfunded mandate.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I appreciate the co-chair's comments, but I think that it isn't clear to the local agencies whether they'll need to budget money for this or not. I direct your attention to page 4, Section 10, subsection B, which says each law enforcement agency subject to the plan is entitled to grants as provided in Section 4 of this section. This subsection B, it describes the process for planning, putting the plan in place for the shape of the plan. So I don't think it's clear at all whether you have grants that are available for the development of the plan or the implementing of the plan or the revising of the plan.
Representative. Senator Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. There was one further question. I was wondering, I understand that the Chiefs of Police and the Sheriff's Association had been supporting this bill. I wondered if either or both of these groups have had an opportunity to review this today's amendment and to weigh in on today's amendment.
Mr.
Co-Chair, Senator Wixit, the only effect of the amendment is to delete the provisions that dealt with the grand jury and to restore the use, or to repeal or remove, rather, the sunsetting of the use of the inquest jury. What is here before is the same. These are all portions of the bill that have existed from the beginning. These are not new provisions. They represent the remainder of the original introduced measure, which those organizations endorsed after taking out the grand jury portion and dealing with the inquest jury.
Thank you. I assume the short answer was no, then?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Very good. Good discussion. It's almost done, then. Senator Boylan?
Just to add a couple of other pieces of information. I want to thank Steve Dole from Crime Victims United for his support in helping us get to this hour and this minute by taking out, making the amendment to the bill. Mr. Dole and his organization are able to support the measure before us, and I personally appreciate that very much. I also want to put on record, and this is very, very important, because these tragic events are going to occur. They are going to occur. Some agencies provide mental health support for officers who were the physical cause of death or who were ordered to use deadly force, and some agencies do not provide that mental health support. This measure provides for state-subsidized mental health support for all qualifying Oregon law enforcement professionals. And then further, under current statute, no law protects officers from being immediately returned to service after having exercised lethal force. This measure prohibits returning highly traumatized officers to anything other than light-duty service before at least 72 hours have elapsed. And again, these provisions, these very thoughtful provisions, were identified by the task force that the Attorney General convened that started its work back in 2004.
Further discussion? Seeing none, let's do a roll call vote.
Representative Morgan?
No.
Representative Hannah?
No.
Representative Jensen?
Yes.
Representative Gerard?
No.
Representative Galizio?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Courtesy, aye.
Vice Chair Nathanson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Nolan?
Yes.
Senator Wesson?
Aye.
Senator Gordon?
Aye.
Senator Winters?
Aye.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Devlin?
Aye.
Senator Morse?
Aye.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Carter?
Aye.
Senator Co-Chair Schrader?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Mr. Yes, Representative Jensen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I wanted to comment before the vote was made, but commenting after the vote was made is adequate for me, if you will allow such to take place. As already found out, I voted for the bill, but I'd like to make the observation that I fully expect that this bill for this issue will be back in front of the E-Board for additional funding, or in front of the 07 session for additional funding. And I'm disturbed a little bit that the questions that have been asked, as I read the bill, were not answered in a point that I think that there's an understanding of what the bill really does. I think that the writing of the bill is pretty simple, pretty straightforward, and I believe it doesn't address the issues. I think there definitely is an unfunded mandate. I see a lot of they shalls throughout this, and if they shall do this planning group, just that is an unfunded mandate, which may be fairly expensive, especially to some areas. Having said that, and having already been on record for the yes, I appreciate that this even though, as indicated, many of our counties do have plans in place, many of our jurisdictions do have, and perhaps all of them do, for all I know, this is certainly an extremely important and sensitive topic, and one that we need to do everything within our power, I think, to be able to avoid negative implications. We need to do everything in our power to avoid the use of deadly force where it's not necessary, and to make sure that when it is used, that we are able to explain to the public to their satisfaction force was used in a legitimate way and had met all the criteria. So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Very good. Fellow Co-Chair, you have some comments, please.
Mr. Co-Chair and colleagues, if I might change the subject, I have two brief items I would like to do. As I listened to our discussion this morning on another bill and this afternoon on this bill, it became evident to me that, in fact, this committee does once in a while venture into policy. It is sometimes hard to keep the fiscal separate from the policy. But yesterday I inappropriately rebuked one of our members for trying to bring us into policy on another bill. And I would like to offer a sincere and personal apology to Representative Hannah for that.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
And finally, Mr. Co-Chair, a couple of our members missed our farewell celebration last night, but if they thought they got off the hook entirely, they are mistaken.
Now they're on tape.
Representative Gerard, to thank you for your service on the committee, the co-chair and I would like to give you an official Ways and Means mouse pad, and everyone last night got bumper stickers that were unique to them, and yours, sir, is a wish that you may live in interesting times.
This is complete.
Madam Co-Chair, can you give the House members the assurances that weren't here last night that everything they're getting is under $10?
Oh, yes. And Representative Hannah, if we might also give you a gift to commemorate your service here. We're on mousepad, so you can think of us every time you are clicking away. And a little thought that Democrats think the glass is half full, Republicans think the glass is theirs. And finally, for the ranking Republican from the House on Ways and Means, my good friend, Representative Morgan, your very own commemorative mouse pad, and a little memento for you that says, Earth first. We'll clear-cut the other planets later.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'll put this one with my other bumper sticker that says, Earth first, we'll mine the other planets.
Here you go.
Bravo. Fair
Thank you all.
Very good.